may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again on truth2you.org. That's truth2you.org. I'm Jono, and joining me from Jakarta, Indonesia, is the author of the recently released Let's Get Biblical, Why Doesn't Judaism Accept the Christian Messiah, Volume 1 and 2. You can get a copy from his website, Outreach Judaism. Welcome back to the program, Rabbi Tobias Singer.
Ah, I love that. Do the rabbi. Like, do rabbi like one more time. I like
the rolling of the R, the rabbi, yeah. Tobias Singer. Not everyone can do that.
The truth is, we can do away with all these titles, rabbi, shmabbi. Call me the leader of the free world, and it's good enough. You don't need all these accolades.
Then I don't get to do the
I didn't know in Australia they could do that.
I'm the only one. Outreachjudaism.org is the website. Just a reminder that if you don't have the books already, people, come on, there's still stock left, but get it now. It's vital reading for everybody. What is new? Now, you've got some news.
Yeah, some very exciting news. I'm coming November 8th in Houston, Texas. I'll be debating one of the preeminent Christian scholars of the New Testament, Dr. Craig Evans, a professor from Acadia University up in Canada, and the Houston Baptist University is bringing him in, and I'll be debating Saturday night at 7 p.m. I'd encourage listeners, the auditorium holds a little less than 300 people, so there's a limited number of seating. So if you are interested in actually joining me and joining Dr. Evans for the debate, which should be a very lively discussion, do go to Houston Baptist University. Don't go there as a student. I'm joking. But suddenly all these Chabad Lubavitchers are going to go to Houston. No, Baptist, no. But if you go on their website, and you can then register, and if you register, then you are assured a seat in the auditorium. It is going to be filmed. The debate is going to be filmed, and exactly how it will be released, we haven't worked out all the details, but I'm really looking forward to that, because Dr. Evans is a preeminent New Testament scholar, and as such, this is something I've been looking forward to for a long time, and I'm very excited about spending this time in November debating. The only problem is that we're debating a relatively trivial issue, and that is, was Jesus the promised Messiah? That means it's the heart of it. And it really goes to, in the Christian Bible, there's a lot of arguing going on, and especially for Paul, which is the earliest writings in the Christian canon, chronologically, it's the earliest that we have. Paul is arguing. He has many more enemies than friends, and he's primarily arguing not with Jews who don't believe in the claims of Christianity. He's arguing with other Christians who believe that he was a fraud, a phony, and a fake, and he was teaching aberrant teaching. We see this very clearly, that, and Paul's reaction is very strong in saying, no, what I have is not just from anyone. I got it from directly from Jesus. And in fact, his claim will affect the way he and the book of Acts presents his movements, his itinerary, because in Acts, if you just trace Acts and Paul, you'll see that the where they went at what stage is recorded very different. And as usual, Christians typically look at the book of Acts, written very late, let's say 85, 90, it's essentially volume 2 to the book of Luke. But they sort of conflate it all, but it should not be. But the key is, the most important question is, is Jesus the promised Messiah? Because people use the term Jesus Christ all the time, but Christ is not the last name. Christ is a claim. It's a rather fantastic claim that requires fantastic evidence, and that's what we're going to explore and examine in this upcoming debate. And I know a lot of people are very excited about it and looking
that
forward
sounds,
to you.
That sounds like fireworks, Topia. That sounds like fireworks. And I'll tell you what, we'll put the link on this post so that people who would like to attend, there's only 300 seats, people, so they're going to go very, very fast, but we'll put the link on this post so that you can go there and secure your seat should you'd like to be there. That sounds incredible. And now he really is quite the scholar, too. I mean, as a Christian scholar, he's very accomplished. If I recall, he's written quite a number of books.
Oh, yeah. He's, you know, that's why I was very excited about this. He's someone who's a preeminent scholar who's written more than 60 papers and books in his life, and therefore it's important, you know, for me not to to debate, you know, someone unless they are in fact they represent a mainstream Christian scholarship. I mean, I've had people want to debate me, but, you know, have very strange beliefs or do not believe what mainstream evangelical Christians hold. And that's very important to me. There's no point in me doing that. And the second thing is that he's widely respected as one of the preeminent Christian apologists in the world, not just in North America. So as a result of that, I think it'll be a very valuable exchange, a very lively exchange, and I'm very excited about this, and I'm very grateful to a whole bunch of organizations that were involved in assembling this and making this possible. A number of them are Christian organizations, and they're Jewish organizations that all got together and made this happen. So I'm very excited about that.
November, people, link on this post. If you can be there, it's going to be very exciting.
Right. Yeah.
Dr. Craig Evans, and quite the Christian theologian. Now, speaking of Christian theology, Tobia, we have a question. We have a question from my friend Jeremy in Hawaii. G'day, Jeremy. Jeremy, great guy. He and I went to Israel together for the first time. We went together, and it was I have a lot of fond memories of being there with Jeremy, and he wrote and he said, listen, dual fulfillment prophecies, where did this concept come from? He says, is this something that Judaism taught, and are there incidences throughout the Tanakh, or is it solely a New Testament concept and thus a new way of interpreting prophecy, a way that was never utilized anywhere in the Tanakh? Is dual fulfillment prophecy related to sensus plenior?
Okay. All right, so let's address this. The term dual prophecy appears nowhere in the Jewish scriptures. That idea doesn't have. Now, we do have something a little bit different, and that is that in the Bible, scripture will tell us that, for example, that if you want to get a sense of what the events that happened in the time of Hezekiah when the Assyrian army was miraculously destroyed. So it tells us, the Bible tells us, it was like what occurred in Midian. So the Bible is very clear about that. The Bible will tell us, if you want to understand what's going to happen, or as an example, when the scripture talks in Zechariah chapter 12, but Bible lays this out, because if you just say dual prophecy, I can apply anything double, so then anything is possible, all is permitted. Then I could say, I'm also Moses. I'm a second Moses. The scripture does, as an example, in chapter 12, when discussing the Mashiach ben Yosef. Can I take a moment just about this? Zechariah, it's important. People understand the context. Always know the context. It's very important of a passage. Zechariah intended that you read the entire chapter 12 so you understand the latter passages in this very famous chapter, and that is Zechariah chapter 12 describes an end time war where nations will come up against Yerushalayim, against Jerusalem, to destroy it. And instead of them succeeding, the enemies succeeding in destroying Yerushalayim, Zechariah tells us the opposite will occur. Jerusalem will be a heavy burdensome stone to all those who come against it. It will be a cup of cauldron of poison for those. The enemies of Israel will be destroyed. And then as we approach Zechariah chapter 12, verse 9 and 8 and 9, it tells us that God is going to strengthen essentially the soldiers, or it doesn't say the word soldier, but the inhabitants, the Jews in Jerusalem, that even a weak Jew, a Jew who survived, we could say now, a Jew who survived the Holocaust, was able to defeat. I mean, who was fighting in the War of Independence? People who survived the concentration camp. The weakest Jew is going to be like David, even like the angels of the Lord of hosts. Now, in Zechariah 12, we are then told that in the midst of this end-time war, which is often known as Milchemes Gog u'Magog, which is described extensively in Ezekiel 38 and 39, and in the latter chapters of Zechariah, it is spoken of in other places, but these are the two most famous areas. Mm-hmm. So there'll be a great victory for the children of Israel, and these are the birth pangs of the Messiah, essentially, that out of this war, which the enemies of Israel will be vanquished, will be destroyed, the Mashiach will be born. Our sages in our sacred literature refer to this, the Ikvasid, the Mashiach, the sort of the footsteps of the Messiah, and compare the coming of the Messiah to a childbirth, just like in the delivery room, when a woman is about to give birth, there's great pains and there's great agony and thing. And you were there, unless she kicked you out. Were you there when you?
No, I was there.
All right, so she let you stay in the room. Okay, so the but what happens when you know? I remember my daughter. So when it until it happens, there's tremendous upheaval and there's agony and so on. But the moment the baby comes out, there's peace and joy and there's no atheists in the room, and suddenly there's calm and joy, right? That's, I mean, anybody, incidentally, who has any question if there's a God, if there's a Bashefa, if there's a creator, just a delivery room, you're not going to find many atheists. So, so in the same way, when Mashiach comes, that it's going to come out of, it's going to be born out of great trauma, and from that trauma is going to come God's salvation. We also can see this theme in the very famous passage in Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 7, Jacob's trouble, which says that out of your pay, out of your difficulty will come the salvation. So we see this theme constantly. Now, so what we have in view in Zechariah 12, and I'm taking time with this because I want the listeners to understand. I want them to understand these passages. So it tells us that in the midst of this great victory, there's going to be a tragedy. And that is, there are two traditions on this, but somebody or some people are going to get killed. In this, the plain natural reading of this is that somebody gets killed in this war. In, and it's not any person, but it's a person who is highly esteemed. If we go back to July 4th, 1976, which is a date which would have, the headlines in the United States would usually should have been, America celebrates its bicentennial. But in fact, the headlines was that Israel had rescued hostages from Uganda. That was the headlines. And this said, this would have otherwise been a very big headline was buried down because but in the midst of this great success that Israel was able to rescue the hostages that these Palestinian terrorists captured in Africa, in the midst of it, there was something painful. There was a great, very great pain. Who was it? It wasn't any person. And this is just an example. As it turned out, it was the commander of the force, of the Sierat Matkal force, this commander force. His name is... He was Bibi Netanyahu's brother, his name Yoni Netanyahu, and he, Nebuch, was killed. He was shot by a Ugandan sniper. And so So therefore, intermixed in this great celebration, there was this great sadness that this very great person, he was an extraordinary individual, just a great man, he's killed. Now, so it's that kind of juxtaposition that Zachariah is bringing to view here. In that, it tells us that if you want to know what's this event is going to be like, that in the future you're going to have a great victory, but in the midst of that victory there's going to be a pain, and that paining is going to cause mourning. So it then makes reference to an event that happened in the past, and it says that it will be like the event that happened in the Valley of Megiddo. What happened there? So there we know that Yoshio, who was the last of the great Davidic kings. He was a student, a disciple, and a contemporary of the famous Jeremiah. He was a very young man. As it turns out, he went to war with Egypt. I'm not going to get into why, but he was such a holy man. He was such a great king. He was very David-like, just as David went out and fought with his people. Josiah, dressed in the clothing of a soldier, an ordinary soldier, and an Egyptian archer saw him, shot him, didn't realize the enormity of who his victim was, and Yoshiahu was killed, and he wasn't killed on the spot. He died of his wounds. He actually said to the people around him who knew who he was, "Take me away, for I am mortally wounded," and he died, and this was a tremendous thing. What occurred then is that there was a tremendous mourning in among the children of Israel, and the mourning was so great it actually forestalled the destruction of the first temple. So what we have is, it's not a dual prophecy, but what we have is that Tanakh is speaking to us, wants to be very clear, and therefore we'll say, look, if you want to get a sense of what will be, so take a look at that. In the midst of all in this war, which will be a victory for Yerushalayim, somebody gets killed. There is a tradition our sages tell us to go are thousands of years old. Nachmanides elaborates on this. Rabbi Cook, the first chief rabbi of the State of Israel, discusses this in his eulogy of Herzl, in that there is another tradition that it doesn't mean one person in particular, but it's Israeli soldiers. I mean, soldiers defending the land of Israel. And as we saw in the last war, the 50-day war we had in Gaza, that when we saw three young boys murdered, executed, when we see our boys who were killed in battle in Gaza, it caused a tremendous consternation among the children of Israel, and people took their faith and took their land seriously. And that is so, that's another tradition. I don't want to get into that. The point is addressing this, and that is, that's not dual prophecy. What we have there is saying, look, if you want to get us, Tanakh wants us to crystallize for us and convey to us, you want to get a sense of something that hasn't yet happened, so look back at this other event, and that'll give you a sense of what this will be like. That's not dual prophecy. Dual prophecy is a fig leaf. Dual prophecy was born in iniquity. This concept, dual prophecy, and I'm putting that in quotation marks. And dual prophecy is not biblical, but it is used, it is employed by missionaries who are, frankly, in an unenviable position. Why? Because, as it turns out, the book of Matthew, although Matthew should not appear first in the Christian Bible, because chronologically not first, not even first among the Gospels, it is theologically, in fact, Augustine is largely responsible for that, that Matthew will employ what's called, scholars refer to this, we've mentioned this in the past, what's called fulfillment citations.
Citations. So we talked about this last week when we were talking about the nativity story in the book of Matthew, also found in the book of Luke. And so this is relevant to that discussion as well.
Exactly. Now, in Matthew chapter 1, we have a very early fulfillment citation. And that is that, as we mentioned last week, there are only two books in the Christian Bible that make the claim that Jesus was born of a virgin. As we mentioned, the two infancy narratives in Matthew and Luke are not just different. They are irreconcilable. But I don't want to focus on that. The key point is this, that Matthew tells us in Matthew, you'll find this in Matthew chapter 1, it's the very first chapter of the book of Matthew, first chapter in what, if you pick up a Christian Bible, it says there that in fact, Mary is already pregnant. Joseph is the one listening to this prophecy because Matthew has it that Joseph is getting the information. Luke has it very oriented towards Mary, so Mary is getting the information. But the point is that Joseph is informed when he's considering divorcing his betrothed that say, do not put away your wife, for that which is within the womb is conceived of the Holy Spirit. This is not an arbitrary event that the Messiah is supposed to be born a virgin. Oh no, it was foretold in the book of Isaiah. Isaiah was written some 700 years before the Christian mm-hmm. century. It was foretold by Isaiah that the Messiah was to be born of a virgin. And Matthew famously misquotes Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14.
So what I've got, just so I've got it in front of me, and this is the angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take your wife Mary, for that which is conceived in her is of the Holy Spirit, and she will bring forth a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. So all of this was done that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, behold, the virgin shall be with child and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which translated is God with us. Okay.
Yeah.
And here we find ourselves in Isaiah chapter 7.
Right. So what we do is say, whoa, behold, virgin will conceive. So that's very interesting. So what happens, of course, is when we say, okay, let's test this. Let's examine this. This is a really an extraordinary claim. The Jewish prophet, 700 years later, is foretelling. So we go back to Isaiah chapter 7, and we read it, and lo and behold, neither the word virgin nor the word Messiah appears anywhere in this chapter, and this chapter has nothing to do with the Messiah at all. In fact, Isaiah 7:14 reads in a correct translation. I want to make this point that there are Christian Bibles that are honest. I mean, there are Christian, let me change that. There are Christian translators that render the Hebrew of Isaiah correctly. It's not like all Christian translators engage in this mistranslation. No, many do, for the famous King James, the New International Version, all the usual suspects, you know, the New American Standard. However, if you open a Revised Standard Version, a New English Bible, and these were not put together by liberals. Bruce Metzger was a professor at Princeton Theological Seminary, was a devout Christian, an evangelical Christian, but, you know, in his Revised Standard Version, he writes, it says in Isaiah 7:14 that behold, the young woman is with the child, not will be, and it's not a virgin, just means, because the word for, there is only one Hebrew word in both biblical and modern Hebrew that encapsulates and conveys virginity and sexual purity, and that's the word betulah. There's only betulah. Right. Betulah means a virgin. The word alma does not discuss a person is a virgin or not. It simply tells us that it's two things. Number one, it's a female. Number two is she's young. As it happens to turn out, it's young women that have babies as opposed to old women. So it's, you know, so the word Alma simply means a young woman. And if Isaiah wanted to, in fact, the word virgin, Betula, does appear, I think, 5 times in the book of Isaiah. If Isaiah wanted to point out that there's some miracle of a virgin having a baby, he would have used the word Betula. He doesn't use the word Betula. He uses the word Alma, which means a young woman. A young woman can be a virgin. She might not be a virgin. So in the case of Rebecca in Genesis, she happens to be a virgin, not because of that word, because it says so in another part of the passage in Genesis. Or she might be very much not a virgin, as we see in Proverbs chapter 30, 19 and 20, where she's an adulteress who's, because she isn't a virgin, no trace is left of her committing adultery because she has, because she's not a virgin. So her being promiscuous, she could just simply take a bath, wash herself off, and said, I didn't do anything wrong. We have also two examples of the Alma is the female virgin. There is a female young woman. There's an Elam, which is a male young man. And we have that in the case of David, who I don't think could be called a virgin, but he's described as an Elam. You find that in 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 56, and in chapter 20, verse 22. And also, it goes without saying that all the Christian Bibles, all the most fundamentalist Christian Bibles, when it comes to describing King David, when if you look up 1 Samuel 17:56 or 20 verse 22, none of them say that refer to David as a virgin. I mean, it's completely preposterous. So that's the first point. But there's a second problem with Matthew's application here, and this goes to the question that was asked by. His name is Jeremy. Is that right?
Jeremy.
And the second problem of trying to apply Isaiah 7th chapter to Jesus' birth, that Isaiah in chapter 7 is speaking about the birth of Messiah, this problem is even more bewildering than the changing of the word. And that is that the context of Isaiah 7, what is happening in Isaiah 7? And, you know, I'm not trying to make fun of Christians, but most Christians know Isaiah 7:14, but they have no clue what it says in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 1 through 13, or they don't have a clue what it says after verse. They only know this verse. As it turns out, if we look at Isaiah chapter 7 and in context, this passage is discussing a civil war. And it's discussing a civil war that took place some 2,700 years ago. And there was an alliance. There was two different alliances going on, so people have a sense of what's happening. In that, you had the northern kingdom of Israel. At that time, the Jewish people, the nation of Israel, were divided into two kingdoms, and they often went to war with each other. And they were aligned, the northern kingdom was aligned with Syria. That's important. Why? And they went to war against the southern kingdom, which is a Davidic house. At that time, the king was a very wicked man. His name is Ahaz. You probably never heard of him. His son, very famous. His son's name is Hezekiah, who was righteous. He was a tzaddik. But the point is that this war, the Afro-Syria war that took place, the northern kingdom of Syria were very concerned. They were disconcerted about the fact that Ahaz, the leader of the southern kingdom, who's from the house of David, had aligned himself with Assyria. That's very important, with Assyria. They didn't like that. So they went to war. They laid siege against Jerusalem, and there was Ahaz surrounded. And Ahaz was in a lot of trouble because they didn't stand a chance. They had two mass armies surrounding them. Again, the northern kingdom of Israel, and they also had the kingdom of Syria. This is Pekah and Ritzin, these two kings.
Yeah.
And so the context is that Isaiah is sent to give Ahaz a sign to know, when will this war be over, and when, at what point could he feel confident that these two kings who are threatening him will be taken away. Okay, that's what happens. Mm. Ahaz is not interested. You should know this. Ahaz is wicked. He is like Ferdinand Marcos. You know when you know in you know from the Panama, whatever his name is. Mm. He wants to just get out. Yeah, he's not interested in signs. He doesn't want to get signs. They'll give me just get me out of here. But Isaiah says to him, but because now here's what's occurring. God has to save Ahaz, even though he didn't deserve it. Why? Because God made a promise centuries earlier, some three centuries earlier, to his great-grandfather, King David, that no matter what your grandchildren do, your descendants do, the Davidic dynasty does, I will punish them with the rod of men, but I will never allow the Davidic dynasty to be torn away and destroyed as it was with King Saul. So therefore, God therefore sends Isaiah to meet Ahaz, and he meets him by the washer's field and gives him, tells him a very simple thing, that behold the young woman. And he says the ho alma, which is very important. He's basically, Isaiah is coming with his family. We see, in fact, his son Shayoshev mentioned 7-3 is there. And he's, and he's letting Ahaz know that, look, here's the deal. There is going to be a, God is going to give you a sign when you will know that these two kingdoms that surround you will be vanquished. Behold, and he says, the young woman. It's like a point. He's pointing at Isaiah's. Isaiah's pointing at his wife and said, young woman is already with a child. Hinei ho alma hara, which means in the perfect tense, or she's already pregnant. Okay. Hinei ho alma hara, he led this bane, and she's going to have a son. V'kara shemai Emmanuel, and she will call his name Emmanuel. That's the job of Isaiah's wife, to call Emmanuel. We see in the next chapter, chapter 8, that in fact Isaiah's wife was also a prophet. She was a prophetess. Now, that's not the sign. The sign is the next two passages. This is what confuses everyone. The sign is, if you look, that curds and honey will a child eat when he knows to reject bad and choose good, meaning the siege will be done. Why? Because before that, these two kings who seek to destroy you, they will be vanquished. They will be destroyed. In fact, we see that they were both Pekah and Ritzin, these two kings that threatened them, were in fact summarily executed. So we see that it was in fact fulfilled. It was fulfilled during that time. It happened at that time. It wasn't some future prophecy of something that was gonna take place hundreds of years later. That's in 2 Kings 15 and 16.
Now this is the difficulty, because if Christian scholars understand this to be the original fulfillment of a prophecy, how then is there a dual fulfillment of the same prophecy, but that fulfillment is different? Now, is this where we cross over from dual fulfillment prophecies to sensus plenior? And I should let the listeners know that that's just a fancy Latin term, which means the fuller sense or the deeper meaning of. In other words, when a prophecy from the Tanakh, a prophecy is fulfilled in the Tanakh, but then it is fully fulfilled in the New Testament, because we have a prophecy in Isaiah. It is fulfilled, but then by the time we get to Matthew, it's represented as a different thing. It's fulfilled in a different way. How do you explain it?
Well, first of all, this idiom, this idea, is again a Christian invention, because, and it very much emerges in the book of Hebrews, where the Hebrews saying, yeah, it's true, there were sacrifices, so on and so on, but it really was a foreshadowing, and it's fulfilled in some time in the future. That's when it's really fulfilled. And we see this also in actually much more heightened way, which is nonsensical, but we find it in a book that was revered by many as part of the New Testament. It thankfully did not make it into the Christian Bible. It's an apocryphal work called the Epistle of Barnabas, which is written in the early part of the second century, which is a viciously anti-Semitic book. It makes the book of Matthew look like it was written by the B'nai B'rith. I mean, the Epistle of Barnabas is just a hideous document. In fact, that's the trajectory, the later the Christian book, the more anti-Jewish it is. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the author, this of course is a forgery, you know, claiming this is Barnabas, who would have been a companion of Paul. But what the claim that's going to be made in the Epistle of Barnabas, which ultimately is excluded from the Christian canon, is that in fact the Jews never understood their Bible to begin with. The Jews, in fact, God was done with the Jews when Moses broke the tablets at Mount Sinai. And in fact, the Jews never understood their own Bible. Everything is a fulfillment in the future. And if they never understood even the simplest thing. He's going to make, you know, claims like when the Bible says don't eat pork in Leviticus 11. So the author, whoever, we don't know who he is, but the author says, it doesn't mean don't eat pork. What are you, an idiot? No, it means... It's hard to believe I'm saying it, but I'm telling you, Luke, so it doesn't mean don't eat pork. It says don't behave like a pig. What does it mean, a pig? Because a pig, oink, 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 you know, makes all these loud grunting noises when it's hungry, and then when it's eaten, it just lays there on its belly in the mud, and it's all happy, and then so no longer your friend anymore. So, you know, he does this to the extreme, that everything was really pointing forward. The Jews missed the boat completely, and let me tell you how it really is. This is, of course, all nonsensical. The Torah, Tanakh, I mean, Daniel didn't understand his own Bible when he refused to eat non-kosher food in the beginning of the book of Daniel. I mean, this doesn't even deserve a response. Mm. Of course, even Christians said it's ridiculous. So if they did, then we could leave it. that's a good standard. If Christians said he needed Prozac, then it's okay. then we could pretty much. But you know, the Gospel of the Epistle of Barnabas did make it into some very important manuscripts, some very famous manuscripts, as part of the canon. Again, it was ultimately excluded in the 4th century. That's all. You know, because they have to do it. You look at a Jewish Bible. Yeah, you go to a church service. I don't recommend it, but let's say you go. So if you go, don't go. But if you did, no. Let's say, you know, you have those counters. It's a clicker. And I'm sure they have it in Australia. I don't know if this technology has been introduced.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. So in Australia, anywhere in the world, they have a clicker. Every person that passes, they click, click, click. And then they have a number that, you know, tells you how many times you click. They use that to count how many people go in, go out, whatever it is. Imagine you go to a Baptist Assemblies of God or whatever it is church. On some Sunday service, right? Mm-hmm. And you sit there with a clicker in hand and say, how many times do we hear the name Jesus come up? So you'd be clicking all the time. The clicker would probably at some point say to you, enough clicking, it's enough already. Stop clicking, leave me alone, I'm trying to get some sleep. But the reason I bring this up is I'm not trying to be silly, but this stands in such stark contradiction to what we read. Tanakh, nothing. Jesus, no. Jesus, nothing. Tanakh doesn't know anything about all this. So there's this very stark contrast. So therefore, they have to say it didn't really mean this. It really meant that. It didn't say don't. You know, of course, when it comes to tithing, churches suddenly, oh, they meant that. You know, tithing, this is for sure. You have to give 10% of everything you own, and then everything your sister-in-law owns, you have to give it to the church. This is never, no Christian ever said that tithing shouldn't be taken literally. This is the biggest mitzvah in all Christianity. Just make sure if you don't tithe, forget it. This commandment did not somehow evaporate. Jesus didn't fulfill, no one ever said, you know, Jesus fulfilled the commandment of tithing for us, and therefore we don't have to be. And any,
no, that's right. Yeah, no, I've never heard that sermon.
You know, Paul didn't say, you know, if you tithe, Christ will avail you nothing. No, that we don't have in Galatians. Somehow that mitzvah they fulfilled. They were a shrimal and they were a Hasidic outfit. For this commandment, they tithing, and the pastors are running around with $3,000 suits and so on, and the tithing is schmiving. So anyway, but the key is, so they have a big problem. But you know, we had a president in the United States that was corrupt, and his name is Barack Obama. I'm kidding. No, he had a president. His name was Nixon, right? Mm-hmm. As it turns out, you know, and it was the Watergate affair. I'm not going to go into it, but the key point is that it was the cover up that that Nixon sought to cover up his looking into what the Democratic Party was doing. It was the cover up that got him in all the trouble. That was the problem. The cover up usually creates all the problems, and that's what that is germane to this point. And that is that when Christians say, "Let me," there's a dual prophecy here. Of course, if you look at Isaiah 7 and it's plain reading and it's plain meaning and it's natural reading, of course it's talking about a very famous war that occurred 2,700 years ago. But there's a dual prophecy. It was fulfilled twice. And the second time it was fulfilled, the second and most important, is it was fulfilled in the time of Jesus. It was fulfilled twice. And therefore, there's not a problem. We could dismiss this problem that Isaiah 7 has nothing to do with the Messiah, nothing to do with a virgin, nothing to do with anything, anything to do with it. No, it was fulfilled twice. That's the argument that goes. So therefore, and this is not biblical, but in fact, I would relish to ignore the fact that dual prophecy is not a biblical concept. Because the problem they create for themselves by making this assertion is much worse than the problem they were in beforehand. The cover-up here is the problem.
It creates an incredible mess. And just thinking about it now and looking at these two theological terms, sensus plenior and dual fulfillment prophecy, it seems to nebulously cloud between the two, depending on what position you want to take and what way you want to explain it, because obviously there are not two virgin births. There's not a virgin birth in Isaiah chapter 7. Now if you look, and I encourage listeners to do this, if you look up these two concepts, these two theological disciplines within hermeneutics, Christian hermeneutics, dual fulfillment prophecies, you're going to find example number one is Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14, and related over into Matthew. If you look up sensus plenior, you're going to find example number one, Isaiah chapter 7, 14, and it's going to spill over into Matthew. However, the difference is dual fulfillment prophecy says that Mary was a virgin and gave birth to Jesus. Therefore, are we not to expect that in Isaiah we're going to find a virgin giving birth?
Right. That means that's the point. That means the same people who claim dual prophecy all are clamoring and screaming with all their big proofs and so on that Alma means a virgin. So you have to understand. So that means what they're saying is that there was a parthenogenesis. They're claiming that there was a virgin in the time of Isaiah that also had a child, and Mary wasn't the first virgin to conceive, which means this is absolutely preposterous. You understand? Mm. So what they do is they divorce the two. And that's why I say to you, listeners, think. I'm not introducing some fancy philosophy over here. What I'm doing, you know, it's funny. They like to put it into Latin. Why do they use all these Latin words? Because no one speaks Latin. And I never walked down the street.
It's like a Jedi mind trick, isn't it? You say, you know, what does this actually mean? And you wave your hand like Obi-Wan Kenobi and you say, sensus plenior, and then you run away.
Oh, well, sensus plenior is different. You understand? It's like, they call, I'm going to have Perrier. Well, what's Perrier? It's seltzer. It's seltzer. But if I say Perrier, aha, Perrier, this I'll pay $800 for a bottle. They would call it seltzer. You know it's seltzer, right? When I was a kid, seltzer. Do they have seltzer in Australia? Of course they had seltzer.
No, they didn't have seltzer.
They have seltzer in New York. Was a big deal. I'd never forget this when I was a kid. So seltzer was the biggest. They actually would deliver the seltzer when I was a child. They would deliver the seltzer like bottles in a crate, in a wooden crate. There was a seltzer man who would deliver it, and it was there were these bottles, very strong glass, and they had a nozzle on it, and when you were done with all 12 bottles, the seltzer man would come and bring up new bottles, and my mother always warned me, be careful with these bottles, because obviously they're under pressure, because they want to keep the bubbles in there. I never understood seltzer or any of this, because like I don't know. Water tastes pretty good. I never met someone, I don't like water so much. I never met such a person. Like, what do you need to stick? What do you need to stick bubbles inside? Like, what?
It's the bubbles. It's the bubbles of nothing that make it something.
I don't know what the bubble. Which idiot came up with putting bubbles in stuff? Like, put a tuna fish sandwich in my water. Just leave it. This is water. This is a bubble. I can breathe the drink. I don't have to do the same at the same time. You know. But it was funny. I have to tell you a funny thing. So I never told the story. So when I was a kid. So we were told that be careful because the bottles were under pressure. So we were told that if you drop a bottle of seltzer and it was sealed, you could not open it and do it yourself. It came from the factory. If you drop, it would explode. It would make such an explode, be like, I don't know, a Hiroshima bomb. This is how we imagine it. If you don't drop the bottle, that bottle had to be handled with care. This is the most dangerous thing. It's like, this is the explosions. The whole city will be dead. And in fact, I didn't know where. I mean, did you ever hear something when you were a kid and you took it seriously and later on?
And you took it seriously.
Yeah, for sure.
Don't make faces when the wind changes because your face will stay like that forever. Remember that one?
Yeah, yeah.
I thought that was true.
I was told, I don't know which idiot told me this, but I was told, I'm not kidding, that seltzer bottles are so explosive. That seltzer bottles are so explosive. That in fact, during World War II, when the Japanese were flying over, you know, America and the Allied forces, they would drop seltzer bottles. I'm not kidding. And I just, to a 6-year-old, this was a very big deal. And I'm going, yeah, bruh. I imagined in my mind this Japanese fighter with a scarf wrapped around his neck, you know, like, you know, he's flying with the open canopy and he's dropping salsa bottles. And he's dropping salsa bottles out. And he's killing off a whole infantry. So being wiped out by salsa. I promise you, I believe this. Thank God, by the time I turned 32, I stopped believing it. But I really thought that it was this is one childhood thing. That this was a major armament, a weapon of mass destruction. In the salsa battle. And in fact, it made me nuts because the salsa man. He would deliver it, and he was a big rubber Gentile. He was a big guy, whatever. He was a big Irish guy because he had to drag this thing up 3 flights of stairs. And then when he finally bring the new bottle of seltzer, you know how he is. He would just sort of throw it on the floor, I'd be diving under the bed. What the heck is he doing? Are you out of here? You trying to kill us all? But this is the story of the. So, how do we get into seltzer? I have no idea. But dual prophecy and seltzer are very connected. The key is you use the word seltzer. Seltzer, schmelzer, hey, seltzer. How much could you get for seltzer? 25 cents. You call it Perrier. It's the same thing. What is it? It's water with bubbles in it. Oh, Perrier, you know, Achenbein. It's French. I don't know what it is. It's suddenly, this is worth, you know, that's what they call. What do they call the snails they eat in French, the parasites eat. What do they call it? There's snails. What do they call it?
They did eat snails, but you're telling me they give it some sort of
Latin? Yeah, there's a name. They call it whatever they call it, some fancy word. I'm sure we're going to have 5,000. You want to know a funny thing?
Let us know in the comments, people, they call the snails in French.
The whole, you know what's funny is this, is that when we put up the show, and everyone's going to watch us, we have all the comments telling them how brilliant and good-looking I am. But in the comments this time, I promise you, everyone is going to put up not dual prophecy, Isaiah, this. They're going to put up what the snail, the eating
snail. This is what the snail is called.
This is going to be the most important thing you should know. You're such an idiot. I never ate snails, and Jano and I apparently didn't either. But they give it some name, so it doesn't sound so.
So they can put another couple of dollars on the. On the price, right? Because it's Latin and it sounds more expensive, and why not?
First of all, they call it snails, so who's going to go in?
What's that? It's like caviar. What is that? I mean, that's a French word.
Yeah, it's like a fish
eggs.
They should really call it a fish's abortion. They shouldn't call it. They call it caviar. Oh, caviar. It sounds good. So. By the way, I hope that all of you realize how it's so important to both Jono and I never to digress, and that's critical to the show. You understand that? That we are...
I don't even know what we were talking about.
What were we talking about on the show? So the point is that people use a term, oh, this dual prophecy, oh, it's called this, it's called... caviar. Oh, caviar is different over here. You understand? So they brie a blue cheese. It's stinky milk that went bad. That's what it really is, and it stinks like vomit. But they call it brie. Aha, brie, you're a big knocker. So in the same way, they give it these names. It goes to the same thing with like how Christians try to solve the paradoxical nature of Trinity. They said it's the same substance. Jesus is the eternal God, same, co-equal, co-eternal, but he's a different person. So everyone, he's a different person. Okay, that makes sense. Everybody goes, well, what does that mean? It means nothing. What does person mean? He's a different person? Oh, he's a different, like everyone, somehow, he's a different person. Oh, he's a different, what does that mean? It means nothing. It's just a word that just suddenly takes on a whole meaning that has, that explains away in something that's completely oxymoronic. So therefore, the problem here is staggering when claiming a virgin birth, well, claiming a dual prophecy. Because number one, that means you're saying, if you have already insisted that the word Alma means a virgin, if you've already are trying to sell us on Alma meaning a virgin, so then you have a problem, because that means you have to say there were two virgin births. Mm. One contemporaneously in the time of Isaiah and Achaz, and then 700 years later in the first century. So that's completely preposterous. The second problem is even crazier, because if you're going to claim that there's a dual prophecy, so the dual prophecy is now even nuttier, because as was mentioned earlier on in the show, and everyone's still thinking about seltzer, but if you look early in the show, the context is a civil war. Mm-hmm. Namely, the Northern Kingdom, aligned with Syria, goes to war against the Southern Kingdom, Judah, the Davidic house from which we are all descended. The 10 northern tribes eventually are going to be carried off, and they're going to be exiled to be returned in the future, as prophesied in Ezekiel and so on. So the problem is that it says in the next verse, verse 15 and verse 16 of Isaiah chapter 7, it says there,
curds and honey, right. Curds and honey he shall eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that you dread will be forsaken by both her kings.
Bingo! So this is an unbelievable thing. So now, if this is a dual prophecy, you now have even a bigger problem. All right, so maybe a Christian will say there was a virgin birth twice. Whatever. I've never met a Christian ever who did that.
Never.
There was a snake, you should know. There's a parthenogenesis that took place somewhere in Indonesia where a snake had three babies, a female.
I heard about that.
Yeah, you heard about that. But the key point is that if you want to say dual prophecy, you've got a big problem. The sign is not the birth. The sign is the maturity of the child. Cream and honey. What's cream and honey? Mm. They're two foods that need to be processed or need to be cultivated. Cream doesn't start out cream. Mm-hmm. First, you have to milk a cow, and then you got to make it into cream or curds or whatever it is. Honey, you can't just go and say, honey, grow some honey. What you have to do is you have to go cultivate bees and wait and so on and get honey. That's not food that you're eating on the siege. So what the text is saying is the text is saying that this lad, this child, will be eating cream and honey, meaning he will not be in a siege when he knows to reject bad and choose good. Why? Because when the lad doesn't even know the difference in good and evil, these two kings who you dread will abandon this land. So I want to know, when did Jesus not know the difference between good and bad? When did he eat cream and honey? And most important, these two kings will be abandoned and will abandon this land that you dread. Well, it happens to be that there was no northern kingdom of Israel during the first century, during the Christian century. There was no Syria northern kingdom alliance. This is all nonsense, and the Assyrian Empire had already completely disappeared from the world map in the ancient world. That was an old story. So therefore, the dual prophecy, they should... the dual prophecy creates more problems. The only thing is that people, you know, I think what you can take from this is that you should just read the text. Don't be afraid. You're telling the truth. You have nothing to worry about. Mm-hmm. Understand? When people, like, you know, in a court case, when people are being accused of things and they won't take the stand, the United States, I don't know, is in Australia, but in America, in a criminal case, a person cannot be compelled to take the stand in his own defense. But frankly, if you're being accused of murder to the God, and you know you didn't do anything, you didn't, so what person wouldn't get up and, you know, testify? Mm. Of course, if a person doesn't. So what you do is just look at the context. You have nothing to worry about. You're safe. Look at the Bible. Look at the context. Read it. And ask yourself, does this make sense?
Let's do that. Can we do one more in a nutshell? Isaiah chapter 17.
Okay.
It begins by saying the burden against Damascus. Now, this is obviously in regards to a particular time in history. Surely, behold, Damascus will cease from being a city and it will be a ruinous heap. Well, I suppose, can we say that about Damascus now? Is this potentially then a dual fulfillment prophecy? It says it'll be a ruinous heap. Was there a point in history where this prophecy was fulfilled? And are we seeing a reoccurring fulfillment of that prophecy today? Or is that prophecy potentially being fulfilled today?
No. This is a prophecy of that time. You have to understand here that, remember, this connects Isaiah 17. It's called, first of all, Amasa means this is a burden, meaning this is bad news. That's just so you know. And there's a whole series of chapters that do this. Here we have the prophecy against Damascus. You have to remember that what we discussed earlier, that in Isaiah chapter 7, who was Ritzin? Ritzin was the king of Aram. That was Damascus, right? He formed that alliance with Pekah, who is the king of the northern kingdom. Their purpose was to destroy Jerusalem and to destroy the Davidic dynasty. So what happened is Isaiah at that time said to Ahaz, which we just discussed, that don't be worried about it, because Aram, which is the northern kingdom of Israel, will never rule over Yerushalayim. And he also told them, by the way, you should know the other guy, meaning you should know about that Syria, would also soon be destroyed. Okay, so very simple. So therefore, when we see Masa Damesek in Isaiah chapter 17, the chapter is foretells the destruction of both Aram, which and the northern kingdom of Israel. And just as they were united, they came together in their effort to destroy Judah, meaning Ahaz, so they will also be united in their destruction by Assyria. And this is exactly what happens. Assyria is going to come in and is going to destroy it and is going to destroy Damascus, which means that kingdom that sought to ally itself to destroy the Davidic dynasty. So they're all very, very connected.
This prophecy then was an immediate
oh, yeah,
pending.
Course.
Okay,
of course.
Right.
Yeah, so they actually are very connected.
Fair enough. All right, Tobias Singer, we've been talking about dual fulfillment prophecies to do with the Christian exegetical hermeneutics and Isaiah chapter 7 and just then Isaiah chapter 17. And you find it in a lot more detail, of course, in his books. Let's Get Biblical. Why Doesn't Judaism Accept the Christian Messiah? Volume 1 and 2. You can get them, as I said, outreachjudaism.org, outreachjudaism.org. And I will also put a link on this post where you can purchase tickets to go to the up-and-coming debate between Craig Evans and Tobias Singer come this November. That'll be exciting. Only 300 tickets available, so you want to get in quick. Thank you, my friend, for coming back on the program.
Hey, great being on here, Jono. Be well, and look forward to doing more shows. This is very exciting. And to all of you, I hope you understand. Be careful with the seltzer. All right.
Yes.
All right.
In the meantime, dear listeners, you be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom.
Be careful with the seltzer.
What was it? I thought they chopped salsa. I literally, it's a child's memory. I forgot. I imagine Japanese pilots dropping bottles of salsa. That's hilarious.